So does this ever happen to you? You walk into a church and you see the altar hasn't been pulled out from the wall?
I've seen it. Yes. Yes, I have.
Yeah, what's the deal?
Get with the times, man.
So I think my first encounter with this would have been this remarkable place in upstate New York called Lake Delaware Boys Camp. And Lake Delaware is fabulous, and it is an Anglo-Catholic military camp for boys.
A lot of those around, are there?
Just the one, really. Just the one. And every morning, I have to tell you, because this ties so much into what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
Every morning at 6:50 a.m., someone would shoot off a cannon, which is actually a shotgun blank.
Okay.
And as soon as that shotgun blast was done sort of cascading through the foothills of the Catskills there, a bugler would play Reveille. Is that what it's called?
It is.
Yeah, Reveille, yep. At the beginning of the day. And then, you know, there was some calisthenics that you would do. And then shortly afterward, before breakfast, mind you, you would find yourself in church for a solemn sung mass.
Uh-huh.
With, I think I'm remembering this right, 5 hymns?
Oh, wow.
Did we do all 5 hymns? And there was incense and the whole 9 yards. Uh-huh. It was great.
Well, that's the good way to have a fasting Eucharist. Do it first thing in the morning.
Absolutely. Yeah, don't give anybody a chance to eat.
Right.
Certainly not those boys. So that, yeah, by the way, that altar faced east. And, you know, I didn't really notice, I mean, I obviously noticed it. I didn't think a lot about it at the time because I was so busy playing the organ. But I wasn't busy playing the organ at the time of the celebration. And yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious that, you know, the priest, this is the old way things that were done. The priest would read the epistle from the right side of the altar. And then he would move the book over to the left side of the altar and read the gospel there. It was a couple years after that, or several years after that. I was at a conference in Bronxville, New York, at the church there, Christ Church Bronxville. And they also have an east-facing altar. But I had a different impression that day, I think, because my role was not to make music. I was just simply in the congregation to worship. And it struck me immediately that... we were all oriented the same way, and isn't this where the Latin description of an east-facing altar comes from?
Ad orientem,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So it struck me that we were all in it together, like we were all in the same boat,
mm-hmm.
and that the priest was at the head of us, mm-hmm. doing this act. It was really remarkable and beautiful, and it kind of made me long for that. That tradition to be more recovered than it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess the history with this in the Episcopal Church is Vatican II came along and said, obviously that's a Roman Catholic movement, let's pull the altars out from the wall and have the celebrant face the people.
Mm.
And I think the Episcopal Church largely followed suit because the Episcopal Church tends to follow everything the Roman Catholics do, but just a few decades later.
Right.
And so now it's interesting for me to see many Roman Catholic places are trying to reclaim east-facing celebration. And I wonder how long it will take the Episcopal Church to have the same thought.
Well, truth be told, there are already people having the same thought.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing about that movement, because for a long time, pretty much every church that was constructed had an east-facing altar.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the States, at least, all the Episcopal churches that you can find built before a certain date have or had at one point in time an east-facing altar. But along in the 60s and 70s, we got the bright idea following Vatican II that that it would be much more engaging for people if the altar were pulled away from the wall and the priest were on the other side of it. Well, the thing that's always bugged me about that is that was around the same time that we started to sort of more thoroughly reclaim the idea that the priest really is just a representative of the congregation,
mm-hmm.
Raised up for this particular sacramental ministry and not not in any way sort of different ontologically, and not somehow set apart strongly, if that makes any sense.
I think so. Define ontologically for me, because I'm just an organist.
Okay, so ontologically, sorry, means the idea of ordination. There used to be an idea that there was an ontological change, a change in one's very being, mm-hmm. or ontology, that occurred.
So ontology is being.
Ontology means being.
Okay.
Yeah. It's actually the philosophy of being, or the study of being. But so a change in one's very being took place at ordination that made priests somehow different, of a different species almost, at least in terms of their relationship to ministry and okay. to the sacred. Well, along the time, the same exact time that we were sort of revising that understanding and saying, no, actually, if we go back and look historically at what the early church believed about holy orders, what they believed was this was a way of lifting up people who were particularly suited for this ministry, for administering the sacraments, for leading people in worship. And we, at the same time we were reclaiming that understanding, we were moving the altars away from the wall and putting the priest on the other side of it, facing us.
So it seems to kind of counteract that very idea.
Exactly. And for a lot of people, it made them feel more involved in the service. It made it feel more participatory. And was it you who likened that to the sort of advent of television?
No, but I could see that connection.
I had never thought of it in those terms, but someone suggested to me that it was around that same time, and I think that there's something to that. We put them on the other side of the table and felt more engaged with the priest, mm-hmm. and thereby with the sacred.
So all of this raises some pretty interesting theological questions for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is the point of the liturgy of the Eucharist to be engaged?
Right, right. I mean, I think that that's a very valid question to be asking.
I have this great quote from James Allison, the theologian,
uh-huh.
who I don't have it on me. I have to paraphrase, but basically, he's like, "You should be really bored when you go to Mass." And his point is like, the victory has already been won. Like, there's nothing to achieve here.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing really happening in a way.
Yeah,
I mean, he's being provocative in the way that he says that.
I think he
does have a point as far as the celebration goes,
mm-hmm.
because. I don't know if this is fashionable to make a slippery slope argument like this, but, you know, once you put the priest behind the altar facing the people to engage them, well, what happens when they get bored with that? Like, what
right.
else do you have to do with to engage them?
Right.
Do you have to get out the accordions and do a polka mouse?
I think a clown Eucharist.
A clown Eucharist.
Is what comes. Good,
well, goodness, what happens when they become bored with the clown Eucharist? You know, it's like, and I don't want to sound like a fuddy-duddy here, like, oh, we must always do things the old way because that is the only way.
Right. But I think it's worth examining the tradition, especially before we cast it off, or in this case, you know, several decades after we've attempted to cast it off, and say, was there something valuable that was pointing towards?
Yeah, that's what I really wonder. And I guess, you know, we talked about so many Episcopalians just growing up with a 1979 book now, mm-hmm. at this stage. And I think what goes hand in hand in that is so many Episcopalians who have known an altar that faces the congregation,
mm-hmm.
and have not known a liturgically east-facing,
mm-hmm.
celebration where the priest literally has his or her back,
mm-hmm.
to the congregation.
Yeah.
Yeah, during the celebration.
Right. And I do think that's a tremendously powerful image. You know, not that, not to get too Roman Catholic, we know that God isn't dwelling in the altar, but if that's our sort of iconographic representation of the holy,
mm-hmm.
and it often is very literally, because we often put the Sanctus on the altar, so it says holy, 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 But if that's our, if that's what the holy is, then shouldn't the priest be facing that direction too, and helping us sort of all focus in the direction of God? I think that that posture of an east-facing altar helps to convey a deeper reality, which is really what the best of liturgy is all about.
So I have a list here of oriented Episcopalians. I love this. I found this on the web.
Uh-huh.
And there's Richard Mamana.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm saying his name right. Richard Mamana has a list of oriented Episcopalians. In Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
Trinity New Haven.
Oh, right.
Trinity on the Green.
Mm-hmm.
Is a wonderful parish. They're oriented east.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think every... I have to check. I don't think every service there is literally... celebrated facing east, but I'd love to know more about that. Oh, and of course Christ Church
mm-hmm.
in New Haven, that
yeah.
that great Anglo-Catholic place. So both of those are listed here. I have to, of course, give a shout out to Walden Moore, who's at Trinity on the Green. The music there is so exquisite.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been to D.C.?
I have, it turns out.
There are four places listed in D.C. One of them, well, actually one of them is the chapel at the National Cathedral, the Lady Chapel. I wouldn't know where the Lady Chapel is offhand. If I'm looking at the nave, I assume it's... Isn't there a big chapel on the left?
There are two chapels flanking the high altar.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, really more than that, but two directly next to the high altar. And the Lady Chapel is, I believe, the one on the left.
We're going to look it up here. Holy Spirit Chapel. Oh, is it called St. Mary's Chapel?
Mm-hmm. So that that's an interesting case study in architecture, because the way that they've arrayed it is sort of like the traditional image called the deesis, with Christ on the cross flanked by Mary and John.
Yeah.
And they've actually arranged their liturgical space that way.
Oh, interesting. So going from left... to right. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So on the left you have Mary. In the middle you have Christ. Mm-hmm. So the nave, the high altar of the cathedral will be Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And on the right is St. John.
Mm-hmm.
Is that chapel called St. John?
I believe it is.
And St. Paul's K Street, that famous place in D.C.
Yes.
East-facing altar.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Robert McCormick, recently of St. Paul's K Street. And also Jeffrey Smith, my old colleague, who's resumed his resumed his tenure in a way after a hiatus. Back on. You have a connection with Georgia, don't you?
I do. I came from the Diocese of Georgia. That's where I was for about 10 years before seminary.
Which church?
So I was at St. Augustine's in Augusta, Georgia.
In Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
Augusta is on this list. Do you know Church of the Good Shepherd?
I do. That is actually, my wife worked there.
Uh-huh. Shout out to Lauren.
Yes. My wife Lauren worked there for about 5 years after she graduated seminary.
Cool.
And St. Augustine's, where I worshipped, originally had an east-facing altar that they had pulled away from the wall.
Yeah, I think a lot of places, I mean, I would struggle to put a number on it, but I think a large number of parishes in the Episcopal Church had an east-facing altar and then found a way to modify,
mm-hmm.
either modify the high altar or construct a freestanding
mm-hmm.
Counterpart. I mean, in places where, you know, it was so integral to the... to the wall that it couldn't be pulled out or moved.
Right, or especially in historic larger Gothic churches
mm-hmm.
where there's a, you know, a reredos.
Yeah, like the National Cathedral.
Right.
Or like Christ Church Cathedral here in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. I mean, in those places the solution is to create another freestanding altar.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what are the theological implications of that? Now you've got two altars.
That's... Well, You know, it's it reminds me of a professor in seminary who used to say that it's not even good practice to carry two different crosses in procession because the multiplicity of images actually weakens the image. And I think that there's something to that. You know, when we say the invitation, the gifts of God for the people of God, I think it's a more powerful image if we're showing one plate and one cup. Where I've seen a lot of places that will have the entire altar party holding something in order to sort of invite people to communion. But I think it diminishes the sort of unity of that symbol to do that. And the same is true of having multiple altars.
So what's, we're living in this kind of post-Vatican II time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a part of me that wonders if this might be temporary to some degree, and eventually we might see those freestanding altars dispensed with.
It's entirely possible. You know, I mean, there are some cases where, you know, when you've got a whole rood screen and a choir that's obscuring everyone's avenue of approach to the high altar, that I think that, I think in some ways it's good to have an altar that's more approachable, that's more in the midst of the people, in a way. But there, you know, that's sort of an architectural anomaly or a rarer case, I'll say, than a lot of the places that have pulled the altar off the wall or constructed another one just because it's not possible to do something else.
Yeah. The National Cathedral is a really interesting case study. I mean, it's also one of the biggest churches ever.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was there in, I think it was 2008.
Mm-hmm.
We took the choir from the cathedral in Indianapolis, and there was a choir boy who was just indignant. Like, he got a hold of one of the vergers at the cathedral, and he said, "When do you use the high altar?"
Mm-hmm.
And the verger said, "Oh, we don't use it." He's like, "Well, you must use it some weeks." And he said, no, we always celebrate the Eucharist at this freestanding altar in the crossing. And the choir boy, like, wouldn't let it go. He's like, "Well, what about Christmas? What about Easter?"
Right.
He's like, "Well, we still use this altar." And he was just really disappointed.
Yeah.
Because for him, this idea that you would have something that massive,
mm-hmm.
and then you just wouldn't use it, he just found to be inexplicable.
And it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, as so many churches like that are, that have a high altar like that.
But in that place in particular, it's really far away.
It is. It is. It's, I mean, you can't, if you're at the back of the nave, you really can't make out some of the figures on it.
So are we, I guess a part of me wants to reconcile this ontology of the priest, of the celebrant,
mm-hmm.
in the Mass and where he or she is celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've diminished the ontological change that happens at ordination,
mm-hmm.
then I guess the thing that would go hand in hand with that is not to have the person so remote, so holy,
yeah.
architecturally in that space that you could only hear them by dint of a microphone.
Right.
Or you could only see them, you know, in the National Cathedral, you can film everything you want and put them up on screens in the nave.
Right.
You could only see them through some kind of AV wizardry.
But I mean, the reality is when you're creating a space that's that large, like so many neo-Gothic or Gothic structures are, there's no way around that. And there is a cost to that. I think you're right to raise that. We do sort of lose some of the priest as representative, but what you gain is this ability of the structure itself to convey the transcendence of God. And it's a trade-off. You know, you lose something with that. But I think that if you want to convey in a moment to someone that God is eternal and beyond human comprehension, it's tough to do that better than Gothic architecture does.
Well, I won't go down the I won't go down the whole list of. There's actually quite a few parishes listed here that have east-facing altars, including two in St. Louis, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put that in the show notes and let people sort of explore that for themselves.
Right. So thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to engage with us further, you can access our website at writeandmusical.org. That's writeandmusical.org.
Say hi, we're still here.
We haven't left yet.
I'm David, I'm an organist.
I'm Ian, I'm a priest.
And I think that last episode sounded pretty good.
I agree.
And listen to us now, we sound even better. So
it's almost like we're using a different recording setup.
It's almost that way. So someday, in fact, our listeners will be able to hear episodes with us with a, we hope, better audio quality like you're hearing now.
And they'll look back on the early ones and laugh.
Or they'll just be really, they'll be like, hey, I was there from day one. I remember when you could hear the air conditioner come on.
So we're going to have podcast hipsters.
That's right.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. OLs, original liturgists or something. I think that's the other thing I was thinking that we need. We need clever names for our listeners.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. They can't just be liturgists because that freezes out the musicians. Should they be ritualists?
How about, well, that means that.
Yeah.
That's trouble.
Yeah, no. But we have some shout outs that we want to give to some of our listeners who weighed in before the first episode with a contest that we ran on the Facebook page.
Exactly. We did the trivia countdown leading to our first podcast release. And so these are the folks who had the correct answers to our trivia questions.
So congratulations to Abby Shoppy, who actually answered correctly on two questions.
To John Wesley Hodges, who split one of the questions.
That's right. We gave him an award on question 10. Alan Bentrup.
Randy Kinnett.
Mary Taylor.
Oren Johnson.
Michael Kurth.
Robert Richter.
Jacqueline Pippin. And to Kara Slade, who had an idea for an upcoming episode of the podcast.
And thanks to all those who have given us other input via all avenues of social media. We are always welcoming of good suggestions for upcoming podcast topics.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're forming quite a community here on the Facebook page and on Twitter. So check us out. You can find all of that stuff from our homepage, writeandmusical.org.
Thin.
Scene.